This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Coming to the bat for the answers here.
The one show that helps you make better money moves. The program all about your money, your business, and your life.
You guys talk about a lot of really good information that even I can understand.
Call Ray now at 844-RAY-SHOW, 844-RAY-SHOW. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
That helps you make better money moves. The
Ray, oh, I got to get my microphone on again. I can't.
All right, see, you did it again. Yeah. All right,
chucking.
I realized too, as I'm looking at mine, that it wasn't on.
We make a pit stop before the show, and I take it off. Who knows?
How long have we been doing this radio thing now? Are we just getting used to it?
30 years, but
30 years.
I used to have people that pampered me. I used to have a producer that pampered me, John.
I remember that.
Yeah.
We're off Pampers now.
Nice tie, by the way.
You like my
very nice tie.
People on radio can't see it, but it is a very nice
tie. It's a beautiful tie.
That's right.
Welcome, folks. It is the one talk show in America that helps you make better money moves. That's what we live for here on the program. It is the show all about your money, your business, and your life. Now, I can assure you of one thing today. If you miss this hour, you will miss a lot of really good content. You may need to pull your car over if you're driving, though.
Don't miss this hour. That's right. If you have surgery, postpone it for an hour. Just stand by.
Yeah.
This is stuff that you do not want to miss.
So doing some research here, Robert Arnott from Research Affiliates says, buy high and sell low with index funds. Now, index funds have been all the rage over the past decade or so. Literally trillions and trillions of dollars have left active management and have gone into index funds, and they've performed fairly well. But Robert Arnott's research, basically titled, by the way, Buy High and Sell Low with Index Funds, looks at how index funds manage their portfolios, including what they buy, when they buy, what they sell, and when they sell. I'm going to do my very best to get to that. It's really, really interesting. Those of you that have gone for the market capitalization weighted index funds may be very, very surprised what your index fund actually owns and how much and what percentage of the stocks in the index they do own.
Buy high and sell low. Doesn't that go against like the first thing you learn in investing school?
That's the problem.
Yes.
That is indeed the problem.
Yes.
Because when you buy an index fund, that is essentially what you're doing.
Gee.
Despite the fact that the momentum has made the big stocks bigger. Anyway, I'll get to that a little bit later. Also, Michael Fink interviewed Nobel laureate Bill Sharp. I picked up a couple of really interesting points. A little complicated, but then again, you tune into this show because we will do our very best to make the complicated simple.
There you go.
So that you can understand it.
Yes.
But obviously, he's 84, 85 years old. Guy's been around a long time. Nobel laureate. And he, if you can believe this, seems to think that an income annuity is not such a bad thing.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that one of his neighbors, who's a billionaire, says don't buy them. Also, 75% of business economists expect a U.S. recession by 2021. Yeah, so what? We'll talk a little bit about that. But I start today with this. Advisors, don't waste your time on manager selection. This also from Research Affiliates. Folks, I want you to sit back, relax, because the Ray Revolution is starting right now with one of the great songs of all time.
Hey, this guy is covering your song.
I used to do this song. Still do this song. I don't do it as well as Neil Young, but I get close.
It's, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Hello, Mr. Soul.
You got to sing like him.
Oh, he's
now,
he's
the one
great.
You did, the recording was like twice as fast.
Oh, it was really fast,
it
really
was,
fast.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to read from this because this is amazing. Because so many advisors, just like so many investors, have what we call in the biz, recency bias. Research Affiliates is warning advisors that past is not prologue. And manager selection may not be worth the effort at this stage, late stage of the economic cycle and bull market. Quote, we, as in research affiliates, can't find anything in the data in academic circles that indicates that manager selection is a high value add activity for financial advisors. Yet, what do financial advisors do? The first thing they do is they pull out the performance of their five-star fund or their star manager. I had a conversation with an advisor about this just yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
And he said, well, XYZ managers beat the S&P for the last 10 years, blah, 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 blah. And I think I'll go with him. I said, well, you know Murphy's Law. The minute you put your client's money into one of these managers that beat the S&P for the last 10 years, they underperformed for the next 10. There's no statistical significance to that. He goes on, advisors who go along with such performance chasing are catering to clients when there are many other things they can and should do to add more value. Remember, we had, and I think we have an email on this, a discussion a couple of weeks ago about best practices in financial advisors.
Yes, we
nowhere,
do have an email coming up.
Nowhere in the best practices of financial advisors does chasing performance of a money manager fit. There's no best practices that says, yeah, go after those managers that have the best performance.
We'll talk about that in conjunction with one of the emails coming
okay.
up.
Past long-term returns of U.S. equities are negatively correlated with their future long-term returns, whether we use a horizon of 10, 20, or 30 years, according to somebody named West, May West, John West, who's the head of client strategy.
Now, you're going to have to explain what that means. And we've talked about negative correlation before. We've talked about discorrelation before.
Right. So negative correlation means basically if one's going up, the other's going down. So when we say past long-term returns of U.S. equities are negatively correlated with their future long-term returns, it means if you're chasing the return of a portfolio, a manager, a mutual
right.
fund, or whatever, and that's done really well over the next or the last 10 years, that performance is negatively correlated to how it's going to do over the next 10 years. In other words, it ain't going to repeat.
Yeah.
No two-peat or three-peat.
Historically speaking, of course.
Historically speaking. A better and easier way to add value for asset selection, says West, is to choose a transparent strategy that emphasizes those factors that drive returns over the long term, such as portfolio turnover, transaction costs, liquidity, and certain factors such as value investing. This is where the best practices come in, because some managers actually turn over their portfolio 100% or more every single year.
Every year?
Yeah. Well, take a look at the average mutual fund. I think you'll find the average mutual fund has close to 100% turnover.
That's a lot of...
It's a lot of
buying and selling.
Now, they may hold one stock for 10 years, but they may buy and sell another stock 10 times over the course of a year.
Okay. Well, yeah, they have their reasons, I suppose.
Every time they do that, there's a transaction cost. That transaction cost is usually not seen in any prospectus. Stress, low turnover, and the largest, most liquid names. Obviously, if you're buying large liquid names, the bid offer spreads are lower. The actual costs, if you're buying small cap stocks, the spreads are much higher.
Of course.
It could cost you 2 or 3% instead of, you know, 10 basis points.
That means the difference between what you're paying for and what you're getting.
Exactly.
Yes.
But if advisors must regularly assess performance, which most do, then they should focus on performance relative to expectation distributions, such as its benchmark. What are they talking about here? They're saying you can't compare a manager A with manager B if manager A's benchmark is the Standard & Poor's 500, and manager B's benchmark is the Russell 2000. One benchmark is large company stocks. The other benchmark is small company stocks. So it would only stand to reason if for the last 10 years, small company stocks have outperformed and you're looking at a large manager, and the advisor comes in and says, let's switch to this manager because look at his performance, you may not be comparing an apple to an apple. Make sense?
That makes sense to me. And you do. It's important to do that. You have to understand what you're comparing. And a lot of times people get that wrong to the point that they make incorrect assumptions and come to incorrect conclusions.
Okay. When we come back from the break, I will finish with the summary. You're not going to want to miss that either. And then move on to some of the other very compelling topics we have to discuss this hour of Money Power. If you'd like to get on board, the call is free. The advice is priceless. 844-RAY-SHOW. Call us now, 844-729-7469, or shoot us an email at raylucia.com.
Download the Biz Talk Radio app, available in iOS, Android, and BlackBerry. Biz Talk Radio.
Today about advisors chasing performance. And I should also say investors, DIY investors chasing performance.
Do it yourself, in other words.
The whole recency bias thing is a very, very dangerous bias because we make the false assumption that just because a manager done good over the last 5 years, 10 years, doesn't necessarily mean they're going to do good over the next 10 years. And in fact, as we learned last segment, their performance is negatively correlated. First 10-year performance is negatively correlated to the last 10 years, or the next 10 years of performance. So this fellow by the name of Jonathan Troussard from Research Affiliates had this to say. He's the one that did the summary. So let me do this and then we'll move on. Troussard includes a performance chart of 8 hypothetical long-only value strategies over the 50 years ended December 31, 2017. What are those strategies? Price to book, earnings to price, cash flow to price, dividends to price, sales to price, assets to price, operating profits to price, and dividends plus buybacks to price. So those are all ways that value managers evaluate the companies and put their stocks into, say, a portfolio, a long-only value portfolio, where they're buying presumably undervalued stocks.
That's the idea.
Yeah. So here's what he goes on to say. All of those strategies generated annual returns greater than that of the S&P 500, ranging between 11.4% and 12.8% versus 10.6%. So now, if you want to beat the S&P 500, I guess they're saying you can do it. Go long, value, and follow one or more of those strategies. Half of those strategies had less volatility than the large cap benchmark. That's pretty cool, too. Now, they go on, breaking down those annualized returns over 10 five-year periods shows that none, I repeat, none of the 8 strategies persistently outperformed or underperformed. For example, the sales-to-price strategy ranked high in the five-year window from 1988 to 1992, then fell to the bottom ranking in the next 5 years, and reverted to a top ranking over the next 2 5-year windows.
How often have we seen this? I mean, this goes on all the time.
It's stuff that you and I know because we've been doing this so long, but the average DIY investor out there, and I hate to say this, but the average broker on the hunt for AUM, assets under management, either knows it and ignores it in an effort to try to get the business, or just flat doesn't know it.
It's probably about half and half.
The assets to price strategy showed that same pattern in reverse. The lowest ranking in the 1983 to 1987 period, the highest ranking in the 1993 to 97 period, but placed near the middle from 2013 to 2017. Quote, and I'll finish with this. We see here quite clearly that the process of mean reversion turns return-chasing behavior into a drag on investment outcomes. This is Research Affiliates. This is legitimate academic stress testing of various strategies. And what they're saying is, even though a strategy may have worked over the short run, it was not persistent over the long run. And so trying to make short-term decisions based on performance of a money manager is an exercise in futility. You must focus on the best practices if you're going to be a financial advisor and you want to make a real difference in your client's portfolio.
Can you just explain briefly? I know we'll have an email coming up on this, but explain briefly for the folks listening now when you say best practices.
Well, let's focus on that which you can control. You can control to a certain extent where you place taxable investments and where you place tax-free investments, where you place tax-deferred investments, and so forth between pre-tax accounts, tax-free accounts like Roths, tax-deferred accounts like annuities and 401k plans, all of which may give you, and brokerage accounts, et cetera, may give you a tax treatment from zero taxes to capital gains taxes to ordinary income taxes. That's just one of many.
Many.
Whether or not you utilize a safe max withdrawal strategy when you ultimately get to retirement, are you following a 4% rule, which I would argue is a mistake? Are you looking at different ways to drain the portfolio as opposed to the standard systematic withdrawal? And I could go on and on. I could do a whole show on it, and I probably will someday.
You know, people hear these terms like systematic withdrawal and all that stuff. I think we sometimes throw them off the, you know, top of our heads. Systematic withdrawal is basically what most advisors tend to do because it's easy. They have a nice pie chart. They have a nice graph that says you're 60-40 or 60-30-10 stocks, bonds, and cash. I've got this nice thing. Oh, you need some income? We'll just sell some stuff right off the top, right across the board, give you the income that you need, rebalance, and that's it. And then they're done. There's no work to it.
Oh, you just described the systematic withdrawal very well, by the way.
Well, yeah, I've seen it.
You have seen it. And while that system can work, the bigger problem associated with that and virtually all strategies is individuals don't stay with them. They don't stay with the strategy. The other thing that doesn't do is it doesn't necessarily address the sequence of returns.
It doesn't at all.
And in many instances, the whole rebalancing methodology may cause you to, you know, potentially buy high and sell low. It could cause all kinds of issues with respect to the sequence risk.
Well, and again, here we go again. Sequence risk, meaning you retire at quote unquote the wrong time. Right when you retire, the first 5 years, two of them are really bad years. They don't have to be really bad years. They can be just down years. It's those early years that have an effect on your later returns. Now, on the systematic withdrawal method that we talked about a second ago, where they just sell a portion and hope for the best, it can actually work out in your favor if the markets are good. It can work out actually better if the markets are in your favor than it would, you know, say some type of, time-segmented portfolio.
You know, 20 years ago, I started writing a book. And in that book, and this is long before most of this research was ever done, it was right about the time the 4% rule came out, right? But I didn't know it came out because I was writing the book in the mid-1990s, actually published it in the early 2000s. Or maybe the first thing I published was a booklet in 1998. In either event, I talked about a hybrid strategy back then. And the hybrid strategy still works. Hybrid meaning, let's say you've got two asset classes, stocks and bonds. In a year where the market goes up dramatically, you could take your distribution from stocks. You could sell stocks at a gain. And in a year where the market went down dramatically, you sell bonds. And you could do that, and that strategy would work better than a systematic withdrawal with annual rebalancing. We'll talk more.
Women in the Army have come along.
Send us your feedback by emailing info@biztalkradio.com, or you can send us comments via the BizTalk Radio app.
Hey, welcome back, folks. This is the Ray Lucia Show, 844-RAY-SHOW. If you want to jump on board, probably get to you next hour for sure. Some emails coming up in just a bit. Stick around. RayLucia.com, RayLucia.com. Click on the Ask Ray button. Why isn't there an Ask John button on there?
I don't know. Nobody, I mean, they know I'll give them the answer, and they don't want to hear it because I give them the truth, that kind of thing.
And I give them a bunch of BS. Is that what you're saying?
I guess I was inferring that, wasn't I?
So I read this, I teased this the other day, never got to it. And I apologize, but we have so much data that we cover on this program. I can't get to everything, but I promise you this will help. It was something written by Ben Carlson, Edges That Won't Go Away. What are your edges in investing? Are you patient enough to get rich slowly? That's the best edge in reality. And I'll tell you more about that in a second. But let me just read from Ben real quick and we'll comment. Quote, strategies that work beautifully in the past can stop working from increased competition, changing market dynamics, or more informed investors. We've seen this all the time with technical analysis and all that. There might be some, you know, market timing strategy or a technical signal,
yes, of course,
that when, quote, back-tested, worked.
Right.
But then going forward, didn't, because everybody started jumping on it.
Yes. We've seen that all the time.
Moving averages and stuff like that.
Stuff I don't put really much stock into over the long run.
Yet he goes on to be a successful investor. You do have to have some sort of edge over yourself, the competition, the market, the way you look at data, etc. I agree with most of that, not all. Individual strategies may come and go and come back again, then go away again. But I believe there are certain edges that will never be arbitraged or competed away in the markets. You can't arbitrage, he goes on, long-term thinking. Yep, that is true. Slow traveling ideas can offer investors an edge because they require a longer time horizon. Goes back to what we've been talking about so far on the program, doesn't it?
Of course, yeah. We've said this over and over. It's amazing how much of this research and all this stuff, these articles, confirm what we've been saying all this time.
Yeah, for 30 years now.
Of course.
That doesn't mean we're geniuses. It just means that from years and years of experience,
we pay attention.
You do. You pay attention to your clients that walk in the door, and you can observe the stuff that they've done that was very good and the stuff that they've done that was not so good. And I contend that in the many years that I've done this, the smartest investors, barring maybe one in Las Vegas, who's the smartest guy I've ever met in investing, and he and I both have made mistakes together, but outside of him, because the guy is a genius, the smartest people tend to have the most difficulty in many instances because they actually think they can do something they can't do.
Well, they outsmart themselves is what happens.
Here's what he said the edges are potentially. Buying hand over fist during a bear market. Yeah, you know, the best way to win in investing is to keep from losing. But if you did lose, the best way to win is start buying your fanny off. Just keep buying. Because when the market dropped 57%, all of those that didn't bail out and wait for the recovery may be still waiting.
Oh, yeah.
All those that put their money in and dollar averaged in or just lump summed in earned, in the teens annually since then. Buy like crazy during bear markets. It's one of the hardest things to do.
Well, because it goes against human nature. Human nature says buy high, sell low, like we were talking about before. It's follow the herd. But logic tells you do the exact opposite.
Next, he says having a system about how the world works. I think that's up for debate. But let's just talk about what your system is. Because if you don't have a system, that is a plan. I'm not talking about a timing system. I'm talking about your strategy. You got to know the strengths and weaknesses in it. But I, for example, have preached for years a strategy called value averaging. Value averaging says that in any given year, if you've done better than you expected from your market returns, take the last 10 years, we've always plugged in an expectation of about an 8% return for stocks. Well, if they've done 12 or 13 or 14 consistently for the last 10 years, you've earned way more than you expected. Is it because you're a genius? No. It's because that's the way markets run. They run overperformance for a while, and then they run underperformance for a while. So if you want a system, then what you do is you look at your portfolio. It doesn't have to be every month or even every year, but you look at your portfolio, say over a three-year period of time, and you expected 8%, and you started, you know, with a dollar, and you have $2. Well, you only expected to have $1.25. So you got 75 cents more money than you expected. Value averaging says maybe we should take a little bit of that cream off the top and sanitize it in a relatively safe environment so that when you put in a dollar and at the end of the year or 2 years you only have 75 cents or 60 cents, we can take some of that extra profit off the table and back into the market. And that's one way to force yourself into buying low and selling high.
Yeah, and now the question becomes, how often do you do it? Do you do it every year? Do you have, how much over? If I expect 8% 1 year and I get 10, does that mean I do this all the time?
Yeah, there's transaction costs, and I think you have to look at it
years. Yeah, you got to weigh it. But it's very important because you want to be able to, as you said, when the markets are down, you want to be able to buy when the opportunity hits. Just the opposite of what most people think they should be doing.
So he goes on, understanding then the drawbacks of your strategy, but investing with it anyways. Let me talk about two strategies that we discuss on this program a lot. Let's just take value averaging. So what's the drawback of that brilliant strategy I just explained to you? The drawback is, in reality, you will earn less. It will affect the overall performance to the negative if you value average your portfolio. That's the negative. The positive is it will manage your behavior much better because you're more likely than not to dump stocks after they go down instead of buying them. But that's a weakness in that strategy. Then there's the bucket type strategy that I invented, although many claim they have, but I did. And we can debate that till everybody's blue in the face, but I've got the documentation from way back.
Late 80s, early 90s.
Early 90s, yeah. So anyway, and my bucket strategy is totally different than what you see on Morningstar and some of the others. That's a whole bag of worms. So what is the downside of that? Well, the downside of spending bonds first is every single year, and you wrote a piece on this just the other day, mm-hmm. which was excellent, by the way.
Well, thank you.
Every single year that you sell bonds and don't rebalance, see, I'm not a big rebalancing fan. The glide path, which we talked about, you know, we talk about it all the time, the glide path for equities goes up. You have an increasing percentage in equities, and therefore, in theory, your portfolio is becoming more risky.
Yeah. Okay. So for people that don't follow this, I've got a bottle of beer in my fridge, and I have a bottle of soda. All right, I got 20 ounces of beer, 20 ounces of soda. If I drink the soda, I start with a 50-50 ratio, right?
Right.
If I just drink the soda, by default, I have a higher ratio, a higher percentage of beer, right? You see,
uh-huh.
in my refrigerator. That's what we mean when we say that. It's not that I'm adding more beer necessarily. But I'm taking away by spending this means that I have a higher ratio in this example of beer. Same thing, when you spend the money out of your bond portfolio, you take it out, you sell it, whatever it is you do, and leave your equities alone, they may have grown some with dividend reinvestment and all that, but the main thing is you're reducing the other half, which gives you that sort of positive glide path.
Now here's what's interesting. What you really should do leading up to retirement is drink the beer and leave the soda alone instead of drinking the soda and leaving the beer alone. But you flip-flop
once
you retire.
What you do.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
You were lying, though.
Well, in
your case, you have beer and vodka. You don't have any soda.
I shouldn't have even said beer. I haven't had a beer, and I couldn't. I haven't had any of that in years.
I couldn't even. My wife last night said, "Would you like to have a glass of wine with our dinner?
Wine.
I'm making tacos, right?" And I said, "Sure, honey, but you know, just only because I'm a lightweight. Only pour me a little tiny bit." So she pours me a little tiny bit. She has about a half a glass. That's about all the two of us can handle.
And then you're...
I took one sip, and I didn't even drink the rest of it.
I can't. I don't even like the taste of it.
It was a good Pinot Noir.
I don't even know what that is. I've heard of it.
During the break. I think they did a movie about it once upon a time.
Sideways
or something?
I have no idea.
Systematically taking your lesser self out of the equation. I'll tell you about that, and we'll get to emails when we come back. Stick around. This is The Ray Lucia Show.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO
of The Bullish Market. Keep listening to Biz Talk Radio.
Online at biztalkradio.com.
All right, we're back in action here on The Ray Lucia Program. RAYLUCIA.com. Click on the Ask Ray button. We'll get to some emails momentarily, but I want to finish with what Ben Carlson wrote. I think this is really brilliant stuff. It's called Edges That Won't Go Away. You can Google it and read it for yourself. But basically, he says this: you must recognize your own weak spots. He's talking about as an investor, and take them into consideration when building an investment plan. The problem is it's always easier to see the irrationalities in others than in ourselves. He goes on to talk about ignoring what the others are doing with their money. That's so hard to do, though, John.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. That's part of the problem. You know, one of the commandments was don't covet your neighbor's goods. Well, that's ridiculous, because if you didn't do that, the whole economy would collapse. Right?
You can't put a price, he says, on the ability to ignore what others are around you are doing with their money. There will always be someone getting richer faster than you, and many times in dumber ways.
Now, you got to explain what that means. That's
dumb
the worst
luck.
Part of it.
I mean, it's dumb luck. You know, some of the best investments I have made
right
in my lifetime, real estate and so forth, have been dumb luck.
Oh,
some have
absolutely.
Been brilliant, by the way. But if you're going to be
honest,
if you're really going to be honest, some of those great... Well, we talked about this the other day. When I gave your daughter that high-tech stock pick back in whenever that was...
It would have been like 2004,
something like that.
Yeah.
She's like a junior in high school. She's taken some stock picking course.
That was a long time ago.
And they were only given one stock. They were able to pick one stock.
One stock.
Over 6 weeks or something like that.
I think it was even like 4 weeks. It was some ridiculous
amount
of time.
So Johnny comes to me and he says, "Can you help her out?" And so I went and I found the... I can't even remember the stock right now because I didn't even know what they did.
No, but it was something with some, you know, nice... P.E. or I didn't even have a P.E. It was just something you picked out of the corner of the closet.
Back then.
You didn't
she
need
She wins
one.
The entire
She won it. She won it.
Finally, I will say this. And he quotes Jeff Bezos, who told a story about asking Warren Buffett some advice on a phone call. It went like this. Bezos, if you're the second richest guy in the world, he's kind of rubbing it in there.
Yeah.
If you're the second richest guy in the world and your investment thesis is so simple, why isn't everyone just copying you? Buffett, because no one wants to get rich slow.
That's true. I mean, all the people, think about the amount of money that people spend to try to get rich quickly on something.
It's all about patience and time horizon, no doubt about it. Okay, let's see if we can get an email in. Hit it, fellas.
You've got mail.
Patience and time horizon, that's boring. We want to get rich now.
Well, I'll see if I can find that stock that went up by like 20%.
I have no idea what that stock was, but anyway. All right, let's see. Janice says, I'm self-employed. I earn about $100,000. Nice. My taxes are outrageous. 2 exclamation points.
Oh.
Is there anything I can do to reduce them? I have $300,000 in an IRA rollover, and I'm age 52. I'm single, if that also helps. By the way, love your show.
Thank you, Janice. Well, listen, there are some things that you can do. I don't have enough information to be able to help you. For example, you've got $300,000. That's good.
Yeah.
And so you're not going to be hurting for money. But if you have other non-qualified money, and how old did she say she was?
52 and single, she said,
so
that helps.
52 and single. Here's the thought that comes to mind, all right? Incorporate your business. It's early in the year. You can get this thing done fairly quickly. Incorporate your business, probably a subchapter S corporation. Presumably, you've made whatever you've made, $100,000, she said, for the last 3 years or so.
She earns, as self-employed, about $100,000. I don't know
how
long.
So do a cash balance plan or a defined benefit retirement plan. That'll do a couple of things. Number one, it'll reduce your income, which will reduce your income taxes. But it'll do number two. One of the reasons why her taxes are so bad is, A, she's single. So you could get married, Janice. Nah, don't do that. Just kidding. B, you're paying 15.3% in FICA Medicare premiums. That's $15,000 right off the top. So by incorporating and putting in a defined benefit plan, let's say you could afford to put, I'm going to make a number up, $50,000 into a retirement account because you could live on other money or your boyfriend helps support you or I don't care, whatever you do. $50,000 would save you the ordinary income tax, which is probably about 20-25% of $50,000. There's about $10,000 in savings, and it's going to save you 15.3% of that $50,000, which is another $7,500. Now we're talking real money, aren't we? So that's what I would do. The key here is, can she afford to live on less? Now, she could theoretically do like a 72T election on her IRA and take income to supplement, but you'd have to pay tax on that, but no FICA.
No FICA. It would be taxes. She's going to have to do it for at least the next 7.5 years or, 8 years, something like that.
That is so true. But email me the rest of your information, Janice, and I'll be happy to respond. But you asked the question. I gave you an answer. There are some pretty serious tax savings in that strategy.
Now, you said a defined benefit plan. We only got a minute and a half. You said a defined benefit plan. That's just a pension. It's your own pension.
Yeah, cash balance plans pretty much have replaced most defined benefits. But when you're talking about a single person, it's basically you define the benefit in retirement. So
yes,
I've made $100,000 a year for the last 3 years. When I retire, I want to have $100,000 per year income. How much money do I need to put away in a pension plan today at age 52 to retire at age 65 to come up with $100,000 per year?
Yes.
And the actuary will say you need to put away $78,982. She writes a check for that.
Or whatever the number is.
If she can only write a check for $50,000, then she's going to retire on 75% of that $100,000.
Yes.
So it's an actuarial calculation. You got to be committed to it for 3 to 5 years. So it's not something you want to do willy-nilly. But I have found it to be an excellent way to save taxes and save money for retirement.
Yeah, now to a small business, a little bit of an expense to set it up and to do all that stuff. But it could be well worth it. I think a lot of small business owners aren't aware that they have these options available to them. They just say, hey, I'm paying 15.3%. I'm making this money, but I can't keep it. What am I supposed to do?
Well, what's happened is the defined benefit plans have come back into, popularity in the last few years.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, for a number of different reasons we don't have much time to get into. Yeah. But talk to your financial advisor about this, because you can save some tax dollars, especially if you're in California, New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, Oregon, places like that that have high state income taxes.
Absolutely.
Out of time. Thank you, Johnny Dean. I thank all of y'all for tuning in. If you want to email me, go to RayLucia.com. Now make it a blessed day. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Ray Lucia Show, bringing you the best in money information, answering questions about your biggest financial challenges, talking about your money, your business, and your life. Ray Lucia is not a registered representative of or affiliated with any securities brokerage or investment advisory firm. The views and opinions expressed by Ray and his guests are not necessarily those of this station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult with the appropriate advisors before making any financial decisions. Ray is available.
This is Biz Talk Radio, America's home.